Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, President Donald Trump says he's been vindicated by former FBI Director James Comey's Senate testimony on Thursday. But there are many who believe Comey's remarks laid bare the inappropriate, possibly criminal behavior on the part of the president. One point was especially clear. The Russian government interfered with our election, and there is an urgent need to understand the nature of that interference and how it can be blocked in the future. Here's James Comey on Thursday.
We have this big, messy, wonderful country where we fight with each other all the time, but nobody tells us what to think, what to fight about, what to vote for, except other Americans. And that's wonderful and often painful, but we're talking about a foreign government that, using technical intrusion and lots of other methods, tried to shape the way we think, we vote, we act. That is a big deal.
Earlier this week, I spoke with David Rennie of The Economist to help us understand what we do and don't know at this point about the Russian involvement.
One of the strangest things about this whole scandal is that we know that there was hacking of the campaign, and yet the White House and President Trump himself, they sometimes seem to want to sort of deny that even we know that.
Then, a conversation with Jennifer Goldbeck of the University of Maryland on recent calls for Facebook, Twitter, Google, and other tech companies to become more proactive in the fight against terrorism.
Yeah, there are some things that they should be doing, but I don't know that they can solve the problem.
First, David Rennie. He's Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist at The Economist. David Rennie, it's good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Bring us up to date on the various investigations going on in regard to the Russian involvement in the 2016 elections.
Well, I think listeners can be forgiven for feeling kind of overwhelmed. You know, every time you open the newspaper or you go online at the moment, there seems to be a new Russia inquiry. And I guess one way to be helpful is to think there are kind of three big buckets that we're dealing with. There is money corruption. Are there kind of corrupt links involving business and bank loans and stuff like that involving Russia and Trump world? The second bucket is kind of geopolitics. Did Trump world have a kind of really very unconventional view of doing grand bargains with Vladimir Putin's Russia and things like dealing with terrorism? The third bucket, which is really the one that's been very active recently, is that narrow question about did Russian spooks try and hack into the 2016 presidential election and kind of put their fingers on the scales in favor of Donald Trump and to hurt Hillary Clinton?
So you've got three separate points of investigation. You've also got three different entities conducting those investigations. Start with what Robert Mueller is looking at.
So Robert Mueller is, to an extraordinary extent, kind of the end result of a cascade of really missteps by Team Trump, if you like. They've ended up with what they most wanted to avoid, which is a special counsel with the powers of a kind of federal prosecutor, but not answering to the normal chain of command. And we've seen in so many other instances, in the Clinton times, you know, in the Iran-Contra scandal, that someone like a special counsel can make life miserable for a government for years at a time. What he is investigating is narrowly whether there was collusion between figures linked to the Trump campaign and hostile foreign actors, most probably Russia, involving hacking into the Russian into the 2016 presidential election. And one of the strangest things about this whole scandal is that we know that there was hacking of the campaign, and yet the White House and President Trump himself, they sometimes seem to want to sort of deny that even we know that. There's this, there's this kind of hall of mirrors feel to this, that when you think that you know that there was hacking, that Hillary Clinton's campaign was hacked, and that the DNC, the headquarters of the party, they had their emails hacked. And then somehow people around Donald Trump, they want to kind of say, well, do we know that it was another country? Do we know that it was Russia? Maybe it was Russia, but maybe it was a sort of, you know, 400-pound guy sitting on his bed.
And we do know it was Russia.
So what do we know for absolutely certain? We know that somebody stole those emails and stuck them on the internet. And we know that whoever did that wanted to hurt Hillary Clinton because they only released emails that were hostile to her. We also know that the heads of the largest intelligence services have said with increasing confidence that it was the Russian state, it was in particular the GRU, Russian military intelligence, that did this hacking. But I think even if you're a Trump partisan saying, well, maybe we can't trust American, you know, intelligence. Here is one way I think listeners can kind of feel that there is an escape path out of this hall of mirrors where nothing is certain. Here's something we know. The emails were stolen and they were put out there by somebody who wants to hurt Hillary Clinton. Here's another thing we know. We know that when Donald Trump, the president of America, and his inner circle are asked who they trust more to explain this story, do they trust the Russian government's version or do they trust their own American intelligence services? Time and again, they put more confidence in the Russians, including Russian intelligence, than they do in American intelligence. So I think if people are feeling a bit overwhelmed and a bit lost and there's so much out there, just focus on that. Something really bad happened, a direct attack on American democracy, and the current president consistently is more willing to take the word of the Russian government than his own American government and his own American intelligence services. And that is really remarkable.
So here's the question. How far could Mr. Mueller go in terms of his investigation? What if it led directly to Donald Trump himself?
So again, what do we know? There's this extraordinary thing that we actually know quite a lot. So during the election campaign, when these emails came out, Donald Trump welcomed it. He praised WikiLeaks. He said it was fantastic. He stood on a stage and encouraged the Russian government to find some of the emails that had gone missing from Hillary Clinton's private email system. So we know that. What do we also know? We also know that some figures close to Donald Trump, who at times worked for his campaign, people like Roger Stone, kind of longtime dirty tricks operative for Republican politicians over the years, he clearly had advanced notice of some of these email releases, because before some of these emails were released, particularly from, say, John Podesta, the head of the Clinton campaign, he had his emails released by these hackers. Just before that, Roger Stone, Republican dirty tricks operative, longtime collaborator of Donald Trump's, was tweeting out, it's Podesta's turn in the barrel. There's going to be real trouble for the Hillary Clinton campaign. So we know that before these stolen emails were put out there, people close to Donald Trump knew about it. What do we also know? And that Robert Mueller, this special counsel, former head of the FBI, very respected bipartisan figure, we know that he's going to be looking at contacts between members of the Trump inner circle and Russian government officials. We know that because the press has released this now. We know that people like Jared Kushner, senior counselor to the president in the White House, his son-in-law, married to his daughter Ivanka, had meetings, among others, with Ambassador Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to Washington, D.C., who is also known to be, if not a member of Russian intelligence, exceedingly close to Russian intelligence, a kind of a figure who has his own cloud of sulfur hanging around him that makes most people in Washington pretty nervous about having contacts with this Russian ambassador. We know that he went to Trump Tower, that at Trump Tower, that meeting, they tried to keep it secret. This was between the election and Donald Trump getting sworn in, so it was a transition at that time. We've had leaks upon leaks, but the most recent ones involving that meeting, that during that meeting, Jared Kushner tried to set up a back channel to the Russian government and wanted to use Russian diplomatic compounds to use their communications equipment. Now, that's getting closer to that geopolitics bucket and away from that election meddling bucket. But again, remember that thing that we should cling on to as one of the few things that we know with any certainty, that time and again, Team Trump trusts the Russians more than they trust the Americans. And that's a classic example, and this will clearly come up in the Mueller investigation, that Jared Kushner seemed to trust Russian spooks more than he trusted American spooks when he was trying to set up that back channel.
So the question becomes, could all of what Robert Mueller is doing lead somehow to an impeachment?
So there is clearly a very strong desire from some people who find the Trump presidency sort of terrifying and unbearable to want this to be kind of over quickly. And so impeachment is kind of this very, very kind of appealing idea that you can just impeach the guy and get him out, and then the country will be out of its nightmare. The problem is if you talk to any kind of constitutional lawyer, the bar for impeachment was set very, very high for a good reason, that it is an extraordinarily kind of violent thing to do to American democracy. You have an elected president who you're kicking out without an election, and you don't want that to be easy. You wouldn't want to live in a country where that is easy, because then you'd be living in a country like Brazil, which is, you know, impeaching and dumping presidents left, right and center. You don't want to live in that kind of country. You want to live in a country where it's hard to get rid of an elected official. So the bar is high crimes and misdemeanors. It's very high. It is, I think, a lot of people seem to feel that we may never get to a kind of some emotionally satisfying moment where all of the election meddling scandal is known. I mean, I think it's entirely possible that maybe, you know, I'm speculating here, but it seems to me that we're almost at the point where we know that at some point there were people close to the Trump campaign who were egging on whoever had these stolen emails. You know, if you got some great stuff, are you going to put it out? What did you know? You know, what's about to come out? Can you get this stuff out there? Because that stuff is very close to the surface already, if you look at some of those comments. Did that then cross the line into actual kind of illegal collusion? That's a really high bar to reach.
But at the same time, you've got House and Senate investigations going on. How do they differ from what Robert Mueller is looking at?
So there's a technical answer to that, and there's a political answer to that. And the technical answer is these are congressional investigations. They have much less power. Their subpoenas are much less kind of powerful. They have less bite than a federal prosecutor's subpoenas. And in fact, there may be some technical issues that they will have to defer to the investigation led by Robert Mueller when it comes to the most sensitive witnesses, people like the former FBI director James Comey, fired by Donald Trump, because Donald Trump has told us it was partly because he was angry about the way that the Russia investigation was going. You see that essentially the Senate and the House intelligence investigations have to check with Robert Mueller, is it okay to interview James Comey, and what can we ask him? Because what they don't want to do is to sort of get James Comey to answer questions that then prejudice the actual criminal investigation that James Comey is leading. But that's the technical difference. The political difference, of course, is that the House and Senate investigations are being run by Republican chairmen. And there has been a big question mark about the extent to which a Republican Congress is going to be willing to follow down that rabbit hole of the Russia investigation as far as it possibly goes, for fear, precisely as you just mentioned, what if at the very end of the last kind of tunnel of the rabbit hole is Trump? Do they want to take out their own president?
I am fascinated with the resignation of Jason Chaffetz and how that fits in to this whole question of what the House is doing.
So he had come under a lot of pressure, including from his own constituents in some fairly rowdy kind of encounters with his own constituents back in Utah, who felt that having used his powers of investigation to pound Hillary Clinton and to pound Democrats, that suddenly Jason Chaffetz, this kind of attack dog member of Congress, was going pretty easy on Trump world. And then when he announced that he was not going to seek another term in Congress, that he's actually going to go into being a kind of media talking head and you know, questions about whether he has ambitions perhaps to become governor of Utah or, you know, whatever his ambitions are. It has to be said in Washington, just to back up a bit further, there was always less confidence that the House would be the investigation that produced results than the Senate, because although both the House and the Senate are run by Republicans, there's just a difference between House Republicans and Senate Republicans. House Republicans are, fairly or not, seen as much more reliable partisans. And that's partly a mechanical process that if you want to get re-elected as a Republican member of a House, you probably represent a super safe district. The vast majority of them have these super, super safe gerrymandered districts. And their biggest fear is being deemed sort of unfit by Republican primary voters. Senators, they represent a whole state. You can't gerrymander the boundaries of a state. So they tend to be able to take a more of a kind of long view, slightly high-minded view. So the House investigation, I don't think anyone ever expected the House to be the body that really got to the bottom of this.
On the other hand, the Senate investigation is led bipartisanly, and therefore one would hope that working together, they will seriously investigate what questions.
So I think it's been fascinating. You have these two figures at the top of the Senate Intelligence Investigation, Senator Burr of North Carolina, Senator Warner of Virginia, a Republican and Democrat. It is very interesting that Senator Warner, Mark Warner of Virginia, has never criticized his Republican colleague. He has always tried to talk about this is a bipartisan investigation. People should have confidence in this investigation. You have people on that committee, like Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who is a longtime Russia hawk and someone who had his own very painful clashes with Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign, when, of course, Marco Rubio was a rival candidate for the presidential nomination. So there's a sense that even though the Senate investigation is led by Republicans, and, you know, they have to be careful about do they want to follow this as far as it goes, there are political and almost human reasons why the Senate panel actually could be tougher than you might fear if you think this is just going to be a partisan kind of whitewash. Partly because most Republican senators, and I spend quite a lot of time on Capitol Hill talking to senators off the record, they're really unhappy about what happened in 2016. They are under no doubt, Republicans and Democrats, they're under no doubt that Russia is behind this. They are not fans of Russia, nor are they fans of the idea that the Trump administration kind of fancies some sort of innovative new deal with Russia where somehow, you know, NATO is less important and Russia is more of a reliable ally. That, you know, that sets their teeth on edge in the Senate, Republican and Democrat. So there's a real sense that this shouldn't have happened, that Trump says things about Russia that they really, really dislike. And they're personally offended by the way that this is sort of falling out. I mean, I had an extraordinary conversation with a Republican senator who I can't name. And I said, what happens if you follow this to the very end of that rabbit hole and you get Trump? And he said, well, then we get President Pence. And then he grinned. Because that's another thing. Remember, a ton of these people, they don't like Donald Trump's politics. They never backed Donald Trump during the election. They grudgingly accepted him because he has a hold on so many Republican voters. But actually, they would all be much happier with President Pence.
Let's turn for a moment to Qatar and what's happened there. Could there have been Russian interference there as well with fake emails?
So we are seeing reporting saying that Qatar, along, let's face it, with France, where we saw Russian election meddling, Germany, where we've seen election meddling, allegations even in Britain that some of the stuff involving the Brexit vote was tainted by Russian election meddling. So we are seeing reports that one of the reasons that the Arab Gulf monarchies are busy falling out in spectacular fashion and pointing the finger at Qatar, one of the members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and saying that Qatar was actually too pro-Iranian and thus breaking the unity of the kind of the Gulf monarchies, who are, of course, Sunni Muslims, very anxious about Iran, the Shia sort of regional superpower, is potentially, we're seeing reporting, that that might have been Russian fake election, fake meddling. And this is the new world that we're in, that, you know, now that Photoshop is as sophisticated as it is, you know, we may have to realize that every election from now on, there'll be, you know, maybe photographs or videos of political candidates appearing to be in the company of, you know, whoever, you know, bad actors of some sort or doing the wrong thing. Emails that will look in totally authentic, seeming to show them doing appalling things. you know, even recordings of them saying things. You know, and this is the most frightening thing about what Russia appears to be up to, is even if elections don't go Russia's way, as happened in France, where Vladimir Putin clearly wanted the far-right nationalist candidate Marine Le Pen to win the election, and instead we have Emmanuel Macron, who's not only a centrist but actually has been pretty tough with Russia and kind of pushed back and criticized Putin to his face. But here's the really worrying thing. Even if Russia doesn't win these elections, even if its meddling doesn't achieve the result that it wants, what it does do is it shakes everyone's faith in the democratic process.
Of course.
And that is enough of a win for Vladimir Putin to make us all fall out among ourselves and tear each other to pieces.
What do we know about what actually happened in Qatar?
I think at the moment the reporting is pretty early. And of course, the accusation involving Russia is that specifically some emails that seemed to be the government of Qatar, the emir of Qatar, criticizing his fellows and proposing a kind of different policy on Iran, that perhaps they themselves were kind of faked in some way. That's the reporting. But there's a whole backstory to this. What else is famous about Qatar if you're from that region? It's the home of Al Jazeera, the extremely powerful Arab and English language satellite television network. That's organized out of Qatar, paid for by Qatar's vast natural gas wealth, and is very critical on occasion of other Gulf monarchies. You don't want to get too deep into the weeds of Middle Eastern politics, but essentially the accusation is that Al Jazeera Television is very close to the Muslim Brotherhood, that very long-standing kind of arm of political Islam, and that they have their own political agenda, which goes very much against those of some of the strongmen, autocratic leaders of countries like Egypt or Saudi Arabia. And so to attack Qatar, if that's another way of reining in this kind of small but rich country with a very provocative TV station that criticizes these kings and autocrats, that's all in the mix. If you're sitting as a listener to this podcast in the United States thinking, well, you know, Arab monarchs fighting among themselves, does that really affect us? So I just got back yesterday from a trip to Asia Pacific with the Defense Secretary, General Mattis, James Mattis. I just spent a week on his plane with the other traveling press. We were in Australia on Monday for a meeting between the Australian and American governments when that news broke that there was this very serious diplomatic fight breaking out among the Gulf monarchs and that they were closing airspace and sea space between, you know, Bahrain and Qatar. There was no need to convince the American Defense Secretary that this was a serious deal because one of America's largest overseas bases is in Qatar and one of America's most important naval bases is across the water in Bahrain. In fact, I was there with a previous Defense Secretary last December. If you are an American concerned about the fight against ISIS, if you're an American who was reassured by seeing Donald Trump addressing those Arab leaders on his first foreign trip when he went to Saudi Arabia, and he seemed to have that unprecedented unity of more than 50 Arab leaders promising at last to get tough on Islamic extremism, to start buying more weaponry, to do more of the fighting against ISIS and other extremist groups. If that looked important to you, well, now look at this fight breaking out in Qatar, because that is tearing apart that fragile unity that we saw only a couple of weeks ago. So then, if you see someone saying, actually, in part, this was Russia, if that turns out to be true, then just as Russia has done a fantastic job of sowing dissension within NATO, it now seems to be doing a pretty good job of sowing dissension among America's best allies in the fight against ISIS. What does Russia get out of all this? It gets division. It gets to be more of a player and to reduce America's hegemony. Remember that Russia is essentially a very damaged economy with terrible demographics, an aging population, but it does have two things going for it. It's a very large nuclear power, and it has these intelligence services with a long history going back to the Soviet Union of being able to be extremely ruthless. And for them, the worse things are, the more chaotic, the less stable, the more that other people's alliances are sort of falling apart and people are fighting among themselves, the better for Vladimir Putin. And so, you know, even if not all of these allegations are ever proven, the fact that the world feels in chaos in so many places and that so many alliances are descending into squabbling, that's a win.
including here in the United States.
Including here.
David Brenny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Now, Jennifer Goldbeck, she's director of the Social Intelligence Lab and associate professor at the College for Information Studies at the University of Maryland. Jen Goldbeck, it's good to see you again.
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, thank you. After last Saturday's deadly attack in London, Prime Minister Theresa May said Facebook, Twitter, Google, and other tech companies need to do more about policing content.
We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace to prevent the spread of extremist and terrorism planning. And we need to do everything we can at home to reduce the risks of extremism online.
What's your thought?
I think it's really complicated, which I know is not a helpful answer. But, you know, on one hand, absolutely. And I think they're trying. There's a lot of really terrible stuff that gets out there. And I think as a computer scientist that there are some straightforward things that they could do to address some of the really nasty stuff that gets up there. On the other hand, solving the problem of terrorism, extremism, hate speech, really addressing that is quite hard. And then if we take it a step further to what some politicians think we can do, which is identify people who are going to carry out an attack before they do it, that's an extremely hard task. I work on things like that in my research, but it's really tricky. So yeah, there are some things that they should be doing, but I don't know that they can solve the problem.
First, tell me what they're doing now.
So there are filters that they have right now. These all have to be automated, which is a really important thing to keep in mind. There are millions of photos, for example, uploaded. So text, we could say, okay, let's look for these kinds of keywords in text. And they certainly do that. But think about all the photos. That's what a lot of terrorist recruiting uses, photos and videos. Now, it's a lot harder for a computer to take a photo and be able to tell if that's an extremist image or not. Same with video. And there's millions and millions of these. So you have to automate this. They have some of that. And we hear stories when it goes bad. For example, when breastfeeding mothers, their photos are banned from Facebook temporarily, right? That's because there's an algorithm and it, you know, sees there's a breast and it says that it's bad. So they do have some of these filters in place to try to automatically catch objectionable content. Facebook has also taken a lot of steps recently where they've hired lots of people to monitor the content.
How many people?
Well, so recently, if you remember, there was Facebook Live has been getting a lot of attention because there's been murders and suicides and all kinds of violent things. So in the wake of that kind of press coverage, they hired 3,000 full-time people just to review Facebook Live content. Now, this is certainly a combination of some automation that then flags stuff for the people to go look at. But we're really talking about an army of people that you need if you're going to look at all the content that could be related to terrorism.
Have you actually seen yourself Facebook content that is recruiting content?
You can find it up there. It's a little bit harder than it used to be. A lot of those groups have moved into a private space where you have to get invited to it. So the way that ISIS, for example, operates is that they'll find boards for, say, Muslims in the U.S., and they'll look for people who are saying things that maybe indicate they're just angry with the status quo, which frankly, there's a lot of reasons to be angry about the status quo. And they'll start talking to people just in general about Islam and then start throwing in some more extreme ideas and look for people who might hook on to that, who might be responsive to a little bit more extreme content. And then they'll move to a private conversation and potentially to these private groups. So the really hardcore recruiting or radicalization, if you want, doesn't happen in public spaces very often.
So that is something Facebook cannot follow at all.
They can. They can get in there. The private conversations are trickier because there are legal issues, right? Do you want them monitoring our conversations? The private Facebook groups, those tend to be a little bit easier for them to monitor. But again, not all the content's on Facebook. So if we look at another parallel example, the Marines, for example, recently, who were gotten a lot of trouble for posting naked photos of other service members, they were using a private Facebook group, but the photos weren't on Facebook. They were hosted externally. So they were posting links. So Facebook couldn't identify that there was this objectionable stuff going on.
Do you think that Facebook is taking steps that we don't even know about yet?
Oh, absolutely. They work very hard internally on all kinds of algorithms to understand what people are posting. Some of that just for marketing reasons, right? What kind of stuff are you talking about? We don't know at all what's going on in Facebook.
You know, we invited Sheryl Sandberg to come on to talk about what was happening with Facebook. She declined. And I felt that perhaps she did not want to talk about anything new that's out there that could give away some of what Facebook is doing.
So much of this, you know, here we're talking about terrorism and extremism, but if you look through the history of the internet, going back to the early days of email, we've always had this kind of cat and mouse game with people trying to do bad stuff, whether it's spam or porn, get it in front of us, and then technology comes along to block it, and then they adjust to that, and this is just one of those games. So certainly you want to keep what you're doing private as long as you can.
Do we have any indication as yet that the people involved in the London activities were recruiting and doing what they did on social media?
So I haven't seen any evidence of that. And in fact, even though we're seeing ISIS claiming some responsibility, it's not even clear that there was a connection there any more than ISIS maybe inspired them to do what they did without any direct connection. I expect that'll emerge, over the next few weeks as they do the investigation.
So there has been a lot of talk about what President Trump is doing on social media. Give me your reaction to how he is tweeting what's happening regarding London and his comments about the mayor of London. Do you think that his kind of obsession with social media is something that is helping or hurting the image of America?
So I have very little good to say about how Trump is using Twitter. It's interesting. So this is a topic I talk about a lot, you know, on the radio with all kinds of people. And through the election cycle, I was saying, well, you know, hopefully once he gets elected, he'll stop using it. Hopefully, all right, once he gets inaugurated, he'll stop doing it. And I wasn't all that hopeful that it would happen. I think the most profound part of it for me is that, I don't agree with Donald Trump's politics, but there's plenty of politicians that I respect whose politics I don't agree with. But for me, the way he's using Twitter especially shows a great disrespect for the office of president, which is not a thing that I had experienced in my lifetime before. There were presidents that I had politically disagreed with, but they really respected the office and they wanted to serve the American people and they wanted the United States to be a country that was respected. And the way that Trump uses Twitter really betrays that.
How so?
So let's look at the London attack. He attacked the mayor of London, took quotes out of context that he was saying, and essentially insulted him as he was trying to help his city work through the aftermath of a terrorist attack. Can you imagine if any other like world leader said that about New York or Charleston or Orlando after any of the terrorist attacks here? Like, we would be appalled. And like, that's not a presidential thing to do, to personally attack the mayor of a city that's recovering from terrorism.
And yet what Trump has said and continues to say is tweeting is his way to be in direct contact with the people, not only of this country, but of the world, without, quote, media bias.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And he uses the platform brilliantly for what he wants to do. And I think a lot of his supporters find it very refreshing that he's out there, he's saying whatever he thinks. At the same time, we see a lot of other leaders using the platform in a similar way, but in a way that I think is more productive to their country's goals. I mean, Justin Trudeau, for example, is very active on Twitter. I follow him. And he says he's a pretty candid, straightforward guy. But he says things that where he understands that he's not just representing himself and his own personal views. He's representing the country in the capacity that he's tweeting, where I think Trump doesn't make that distinction. He shares whatever he thinks and doesn't have that broader view of the office that he's in and that he's speaking for all the American people as the president, not just himself.
Well, speaking for all the American people and insulting countries around the world is really the concern that even Republicans, even his supporters now have.
I think that's right. You know, we want to be, it's a hard topic for me to talk about. Like, I sometimes am still waking up in the middle of the night, just upset at the way everything's going. But yeah, I mean, I'm a very patriotic person. I feel like I have served the country in a lot of ways, though I haven't been in the military. I'm very invested in the United States as a world leader in terms of justice and fairness and equality. And I feel like we were getting there. And frankly, so for example, I was not a supporter of George Bush's policies, but I felt like he was trying to move the country forward in that way. I think Obama was too. And I feel like we're losing so much of that ground as a leader representing those things that, you know, I grew up in the Cold War, the beacon that America was in the world. I feel like we're losing that with every one of these Donald Trump tweets that
and you're saying it's the tweets that are doing that, that are waking you up in the middle of the night and are shaking your faith in how he represents the presidency.
They're the most straightforward way to see it, which is exactly what he wants. And I don't think it's necessarily bad to have a leader tweeting like that and being really transparent about what they think. I mean, he's got the policies to back up the tweets, which is troubling as well. But yeah, the tweets are really out there and putting these positions forward where you're not even losing his message in the kind of jumble of legislation and legal speak that goes on with the policies. You have him out there saying these things. There's no way to deny it. And yeah, it's really troubling for me.
Jen, I want to go back to responsibility. And the phone companies certainly never had the responsibility for monitoring content. Why should Facebook?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, on one hand, I don't think we want social media companies monitoring a lot of communications more than the phone company would have, especially private conversations. So think about things like email, private messages. I don't think we want them in there. I think where there's a bit of a distinction is that a lot of social media platforms are broadcast. So it's not me talking directly to you. It's me, for example, on Twitter, speaking to the whole world. It's public. It's out there. It's designed for lots of people to look at it. And so if you consider it that way, it's a form of media where you're broadcasting, then you want the platform where that broadcast is happening to think about what kind of content do they want to host, right? We're not talking about, does Facebook want to support your and my direct conversation? It's, do they want to support me broadcasting hate speech, broadcasting videos of beheadings, right? And we've seen the social media companies say, no, we don't want to host that. In, you know, largely they've said that. And so they're trying to block that. But I think that's the difference. If you think of them as media companies with the stuff that's being publicly broadcast, then there's a space for them to say no.
But who is making those decisions?
This is the hard question, of course, because we look at it from a very U.S.-centric perspective. But you could imagine, you know, being in a more authoritarian country that tries to have much greater control over what's broadcast. And then you would see, you know, a lot of different requests coming through. So ultimately, I think what it comes down to is that the social media companies are going to make decisions about what kind of content do we want to host. And if you look at Twitter, for example, they have said and gone ahead with policies that host a lot of really terrible, objectionable stuff. There is a ton of hate speech and organization among, say, white nationalists and the alt-right that takes place on Twitter. A lot of very targeted, violent harassment that they are not great at shutting down. And they have really taken the free speech platform to a pretty far place. Not the total extreme, but they're really far out there. And they've said, we're going to host this. Now, they do try to shut down terrorist stuff that happens on Twitter, but they allow a lot of this other content. Facebook is more restrictive. They tend to shut down, you know, those alt-right white nationalist groups more quickly. And so the platforms are making the decision, and I think a lot of it is based on a business model. How are we going to make the most money? What are our stakeholders going to demand of us? And Twitter has seen this come back to bite them, right? When they were on the market and it was a debate, maybe Disney will buy them, a lot of reports says Disney didn't want them specifically because there was a lot of this kind of content. So,
what about encryption and the future thereof?
Yeah, this is a tricky issue. Right. So we mostly see this coming up on our devices. So it should everything on my iPhone be encrypted and no one has the key to decrypt it except me. Law enforcement doesn't like that. And intelligence communities don't necessarily like that. And I completely understand that position. You know, if I'm about to commit a terrorist attack and the location of the bomb is on my phone, shouldn't there be a way for them to get in there without my permission? I mean, that's the argument that they make. On the other hand, this is not just a U.S.-based problem, right? So you look at now, for example, Chechnya, right, has literally been rounding up gay men and executing them. And when they're not doing it, they're encouraging their family members to do it. So say that's where you are and you have chats with your boyfriend. You're a gay man. You have chats with your boyfriend on your phone. Do you want the police to have access and look for that? Okay, those are the two extremes that we have, right? I personally tend to fall more on the side of I should be able to keep that private. Because there's going to be bad consequences no matter what, right? If you allow authorities to decrypt that content, there are people who are going to die because of that. Maybe not in the U.S., but around the world, authoritarian regimes are going to use that to find and arrest dissidents, homosexuals, whatever the group is that they're going after. And sure, there is the alternative argument that people will die if we can't get into terrorist phones, but that doesn't mean there's not the other side. So I personally fall on the privacy end.
Jen, there have got to be other changes ahead, big changes. What do you see?
Yeah, it's such a fast-changing space. And so I think that there's a couple drivers. So one is that what we've seen so far in Silicon Valley and in the tech space has largely been based on monetization. And I don't mean that critically, right? I mean, these are companies. They want to make money. And so they have been thinking really hard, how do we make money on this? And we've seen policy generally work in their favor. And we've seen that in this administration. The clearest example of that is the bill that passed both houses and Trump signed saying that your internet service providers now can monetize, sell access to your private browsing history, right? So we're really moving very much towards giving control over people's data to companies to allow them to make money on it. The encryption issue sort of follows with this too, right? So I think that there's going to be something rising up from the people against this. I've talked to a lot of Republicans and Democrats and have yet to find a single person who likes this bill that allows your ISPs to sell your private browsing data. I have not found a single person who think that's good. And so as this becomes more apparent that there's really what I feel are invasions of our privacy to make money, that there's going to be a push for more of a European model where we own our data and have more control of it. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen in the next few years. Maybe if we see a shift in both houses after the midterms, maybe we're looking a few years out to where we have a Democrat in the White House. Then I think we're going to see a dramatic pushback against what we're seeing now. Yeah. And that's going to affect everything. If I have that right to privacy, it's going to affect encryption. It's going to affect online advertising. It's going to affect privacy on social media platforms. So that's the thing that I see coming in, say, the next 2 to 5 years. And if we go the place where, frankly, I'm pushing for us to go, that we have more control over this data about ourselves because there's so much power in it, it's going to be a really dramatic shift in all these online services we use.
But conversely, isn't that going to allow more freedom to those who would do various countries' harm?
Yeah, well, that's the balance to have. Right. So I'm also pushing. So I have kind of two things that I argue for in my work. One is more rights to privacy to encrypt our data, to keep it private. But if we're broadcasting, right, if I'm posting on Twitter, on YouTube, like we're not talking about privacy there. We're talking about broadcasting. And I'm, you know, pushing and working very hard in my own research on ways to detect this, to flag it. So then people have the option of filtering, like maybe I don't want to see this white nationalist stuff, even if the platform allows it. So I could filter it. But it also allows platforms, the better we get at the artificial intelligence to detect this, the more the platforms have a right to block it. And if you have those two things together, if you have a right to privacy in your private communications, and the ability for companies to detect this public stuff, those two work together really well. We can talk about whatever crazy stuff we want one-to-one, but the really dangerous part when I'm broadcasting, that's something that can be filtered.
Jen Colbeck, keep up your research. Keep us informed. You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, from the archives this week, with the general election in Britain, a look back on our conversation last July after Theresa May's victory and some speculation that Russian hackers may have played a role in last year's stunning Brexit vote. Here's Jeremy Cliff of The Economist.
Russia's exact involvement in the politics of Western Europe is very hard to precisely quantify. It's all in the shadows. But what is absolutely clear, and this is, I think, the point we were making in the issue that you're referring to, is that Russia has certainly taken an interest in some of the nationalist populist movements taking hold in parts of Western Europe. Nigel Farage, the leader of the UKIP party, this famous pro-Brexit party in Britain, has expressed his admiration for Vladimir Putin. Likewise, there is, I believe it's on the record, that the French Front National, the right-wing populist party there, has received a large loan from Russian sources. There are also very close links between the Alternative for Germany, which is a very, again, a equivalent party in Germany, which campaigns on a Eurosceptic populist platform. They too have very close links with Russia. And I think precisely what Russia's involvement is hard to say, but what's clear is that there is an obvious sympathy between Putin and his nationalist movement in Moscow and similar parties in Western Europe who like Putin, are sceptical of the European Union, who see it as a sort of decadent institution that's too bound up with social liberalism and too willing to erase the borders between countries. And I think that's a concern that, you know, you have this new alliance emerging in Europe between quite a sort of revanchist Russia on the one hand and these increasingly successful populist forces in national capitals in Europe's West as well.
You can listen to that entire show on dianereem.org. And that's our show for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Send us an email at drpodcast.com. at WAMU.org. Leave us a voicemail, the number 202-854-8851, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.